Welcome to Unintended Consequences, a show about the ways government regulation can go awry. I'm your host, Paul Matsko, and with me as always is Regulation Magazine editor, Peter Van Doren. The theme of today's episode is that incentives matter. Regulations prod or pull people towards or away from certain behaviors, but they don't always do so in predictable ways. And so today we're talking about housing, electric vehicles, and poverty, areas where government intervention has led to surprising and sometimes infuriating outcomes. With us today is Craig Richardson, the Truist Distinguished Professor of Economics at Winston-Salem State University. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Okay, so I want to make sure our listeners hear the personal story that you opened your cover article with. So tell us what happened a few years ago when you tried to buy a house, an actually affordable house, surprisingly, in Winston-Salem.
Yeah, so it was actually an investment property, a condominium, and we were looking for a condominium for our family for an investment property. And found a very nice property for about $69,000, a few miles from our house, and had all the amenities we wanted. And, you know, we had a very good credit. Our house is almost paid off. I thought it would be a no-brainer to go to a bank and get a mortgage. And when we called up a mortgage broker, the mortgage broker who services loans all the time and deals with a lot of big commercial banks, she sort of gave this laugh and said, nobody's going to write you a mortgage for that small. And I said, why not? She said, well, you know, I've been told we don't even look at loans less than $100,000. And I said, what? You know, why? It didn't make any sense to me. And so she said, well, let me get back to you. And so she got back to us and she said, well, you know, given the fact that you have so much equity in your house, why don't we just refinance your entire house and wrap this into your house? And that way it's going to be worth it. And so that's what we ended up doing. We ended up getting a good deal on our interest rate. But, you know, the irony really struck me that for a very inexpensive property that could have been a property for somebody who was currently renting, you know, this is a $600 mortgage a month, who could easily have afforded that mortgage, those folks are now left out of that market transaction. And so they're not able to build wealth like, you know, somebody who's like me, who's relatively well off. And so that was one of the impetuses for really getting into this space, this research space, was to say, you know, how ironic is it that we talk about the American dream and yet the folks at the bottom of the economic ladder are systematically have an incredibly hard time. It's not impossible to get these loans, but you have to work really, really hard. You have to find the right lending institutions, and they're certainly not reaching out because for the majority of them, they're not profitable. So they may be doing them as part of their community goodwill. And so I have found a few of those lending institutions. But it's not, as I like to say, nobody wakes up first thing in the morning thinking, how do I finance a small dollar mortgage, which I'm defining as about $100,000 or $100,000. They don't wake up thinking about it because it's essentially unprofitable.
I mean, it's a, you know, for the average first-time home buyer, you know, they're trying to scrape together a few thousand dollars. $69,000 is inaccessible, right? They just can't do that kind of cash purchase. So why don't mortgage companies want, so the intuitive response is, okay, $100,000, sure, it's not as large as a $300,000 mortgage, but why can't they still make money on this? Why don't mortgage originators, why don't they want these small dollar mortgages as much as they once used to?
Yeah, so this is not what how it used to be, as you say. And so what we've seen really over the last 10 years, there's been a huge collapse of credit in this area. And it's not because there aren't homes for $150,000. A lot of listeners who live in big cities would think $100,000 might buy a garden shed. But there are plenty of millions of homes that are selling for $150,000. In 2019, only 77% of all homes costing less than $100,000 or purchase with cash. So why? Well, when I started to look into this, and I'm certainly not the only one who's researched this, but there has, since the Dodd-Frank Banking Act of 2010, the Dodd-Frank Banking Act was meant to ostensibly discipline large Wall Street banks for packaging lots and lots of loans. And of course, we know about the bailouts. And so the Dodd-Frank Act was really meant to discipline banks and put a lot more restrictions on how much they could loan, who could they loan to, and so forth. Well, these ended up having thousands and thousands of pages of new regulations. And ironically, the big Wall Street banks could afford to do this because relative to the size and to their income flows, they could afford to do it. But the same regulations of thousands of pages fell on these small banks at the same time, and their overhead costs went way up.
Talking about regulatory compliance?
Yeah. So you would have more auditors. You have more. You have to have more training within the bank to make sure that you're, quote, lending to the right people and that the credit risks are okay. So there's a lot more internal overhead costs that are involved with all this oversight. Now, you had that. So you had the if you imagine profits, of course, are revenues minus costs. And so profits are going to be squeezed if two things happen or one thing happen. But in this case, profits are squeezed because costs are rising. They're going up. Overhead costs are going up. Then the other thing that Dodd-Frank did was it also squeezed on the top end by collapsing revenue. And they did that only on the small dollar side. And they put price caps or caps on how much banks could charge for points and fees. And this is, again, a classic case of the law of unintended consequences. Because what the Dodd-Frank Act was trying to do was protect low-income folks from getting exploited in this market. And they said, we don't want to allow banks to charge too much because they might be taken advantage of. And so they put price caps on these small dollar loans. But what they don't seem to understand is that when you have a smaller loan, it's kind of like if you buy a can of Coke in a convenience store, it's going to be more expensive than if you buy it per unit at a Costco. There's economies of scale. There's the relative costs are smaller when you get a bigger loan. The same is true for a mortgage. A bigger mortgage has smaller relative costs. And so a smaller mortgage, there's going to be some expenses that have to be allocated no matter what. You know, you have to pay the real estate agent. You have to pay the banking officer. And so the bank needs to charge a little bit more to cover that relatively higher cost for a small loan. So Dodd-Frank actually did the opposite. They crushed that ability of the bank to do that. In the name of helping people, what they did was they collapsed that and they put a price cap on it. And as any student of principles of economics knows, when you put a price cap on something, you create a shortage. And so this price cap then says to banks, you know, number one, our overhead costs have gone up. And now we have a price cap on what we can charge. So revenues are going down, costs are going up. And in fact, in most cases, costs now exceed revenues. So we have between zero and 100,000. There's no money to be made in this market. And everybody pretty much agrees that. The only banks that are going to, or lending institutions that are going to get involved are those who, like I said, would have some, they may go through this Community Reinvestment Act, which is how they show that they have goodwill to the community. But it, like I said, it's not something that they're incentivized to do like they used to.
So they're being squeezed on both ends, both on right. costs and on revenue. It sounds also that intentions are good. It's not like anyone involved in drafting Dodd-Frank. But they're also going after the wrong target. You mentioned that these rules only apply to small dollar loans when the worst actors, arguably, during the crisis were larger banks making larger loans. It was not small community banks over above in the way that were, you know, I think you make the point in there that a lot of these banks, small community banks, making small dollar loans, they do it on the basis of personal relationships with people in the community. And they weren't the real drivers of the crisis in 2007, is my understanding.
Exactly. I mean, there were probably 25 large banks that were the driver of the crisis, and yet there were 7,000 other banks that were doing quite a good job. Exactly. They knew their community, and they didn't necessarily, if people didn't have great credit profiles, but maybe they had knowledge of them paying rent for 3 years, or they knew them personally from the grocery stores. So there's a lot of this social capital that doesn't show up, you know, in these federal rules, that's informal, but that is now being crushed because you have external regulations from Washington that are supposedly keeping everybody in line. When you don't need that, you're treating everybody as a villain, essentially, or a potential villain, yeah, rather than saying, hey, you know, the problem here was this collection of large banks, and don't treat everybody the same, was my point.
So you tested this theory in Winston-Salem specifically. I think you took two neighborhoods, East Winston, and I forget the other one offhand. What did you find when you actually tested it on the ground?
So what we did was, as I mentioned, there are a lot of researchers who are now really starting to look at this from, you know, from all ideological stripes. I mean, I think it's something people can agree on. The Urban Institute, the Pew Charitable Trust, there is a lot of great research out there on the collapse of small dollar lending, and I'm continuing to work on some of that. But what we wanted to test also was that if you have a collapse of small dollar lending and you go into a community that is a high concentration of poverty and low income, what's going to happen to those property values over time? And when we look at Winston-Salem, we had East Winston, which is divided by a highway running north-south, Highway 52. And this is very similar to a lot of American cities. The east side of the city is primarily minority Black and Hispanic households, and the west side, wealthier, primarily white and middle class to upper class. So my theory that I wanted to test in this article in Public Choice this past month was, if you imagine an auction where you showed up in an auction, let's just say to buy some furniture, and it's an outdoor auction, and suddenly the auctioneer announces, we are only taking cash. What's in your pockets, in your wallets? We are not taking credit cards. We're not taking any forms of credit except for cash. Imagine what would happen to the prices of those things auctioned off versus, you know, the auction across the street where they take any kind of payment possible from PayPal to credit cards to cash. We know intuitively that the demand is going to drop if you only take cash, and that the prices are going to be lower in that particular auction. And so what I wanted to test was, if we have a collection of small dollar homes in a community, and that's in East Winston, where about 80% of these homes are valued less than $100,000, what happened since Dodd-Frank? What happened to those property values? And what we found was pretty astonishing, that after Dodd-Frank, the west side of the city dropped and the east side of the city dropped. But the east side, the poorer side, never recovered. And so what we've seen now, and we do this with regression analysis, is that the east side of the city now, property values have dropped by 40% in nominal terms relative to the west side. They've never recovered. And our analysis indicates that it will take 30 years at current rates for them to recover back to 2000, 30 years. Wow. So this idea that when you buy a house, this is the best way to accumulate wealth, which I hear, there's some, you know, there could be a debate about that. But what people need to understand is that Dodd-Frank, as we argue, has not only impacted loans, it has impacted our, some of our most impoverished communities by collectively pulling millions of dollars of wealth out of people's pockets by people buying a house for $100,000. And by the way, Dodd-Frank not only did not only hurt access to mortgage credit, it also impacted access to equity lines that people could have used to improve their houses. Like sometimes we get an equity line to have a better kitchen, you know, to add a garage. Those types of things are also, have research has shown that also has been hurt. So we have a person here who bought a house in 2000. The house now may be worth $65,000, and they've lost $35,000 in wealth. And so that's the novel twist, I think, on this piece that we did with my co-author, Zach Blizzard, was to show the sort of downstream ripple effects of this, of these regulations in our county. And we think that there's a, there's going to be evidence that we're going to find this in other communities across the country.
There's such a deep irony here that a piece of legislation pushed by progressive members of Congress had such a deeply regressive effect. Like if you're worried about wealth inequality, this made it worse. If you're worried about racial wealth inequality, this arguably made that worse. In fact, I went and looked and, you know, there's historical maps of mortgage redlining. And sure enough, East Winston, the predominantly Black and now Hispanic part of town, was redlined a generation or more ago. And so it's a deep, perverse irony that they were, generational wealth in Black communities in North Carolina were affected by one kind of mortgage regulation that damaged their ability to acquire and increase wealth a generation ago. And now we're doing it again through Dodd-Frank.
Yeah, I know. It's so true. And so if we look at prior to 1968, this redlining that you mentioned where the Federal Home Association would not insure these communities that are so-called redline communities, which were primarily Black households. And so it was explicitly written into law. And I mean, that's, to me, that's systemic racism, is when it's explicitly written into law. Today it's not explicitly written into law, but as you say, it's acting as if it is. And so I won't call it explicit systemic racism, but I would say maybe it's implicit, because it is acting as if. Now, of course, it's going to also affect other communities of different races in the same way. But for Black households who have the proportionally larger amount of homes, it's going to hit these this group harder. But it is something that affects all Americans at the bottom of the ladder. And that's why I think this particular vein of research should not be controversial across whether or not you're progressive, libertarian, conservative. I think everybody wants people to have a piece of that American dream.
So the government tried to protect the little guy from predatory lending by banks, but just ended up exacerbating the shortage of affordable starter homes. Whoops. There's a reason this show is called Unintended Consequences. By contrast, our next topic is about something the government wants us all to buy more of: electric vehicles. Last year, I drove my first EV car, my first electric vehicle. Loved it. I'm ready for the EV transition personally. President Biden is ready for the EV transition. There's lots of pork for EVs and chargers in the so-called Inflation Reduction Act, as if spending lots of money is inflation reducing, but we'll set that to the side. And now the Environmental Protection Agency says that a new vehicle emissions rule will save Americans, they claim, $1.6 trillion in net benefits. Sounds great. Almost too good to be true. Tell me it's not too good to be true, Peter.
It's probably too good to be true. But you and I are going to talk about blow by blow how two economists analyzing an EPA rule, which is 600 and some odd pages long, they analyzed this rule and they went through all the steps the agency used in its analysis to justify the rule, and then pushed back on all those steps, saying, we disagree with the assumption that led to this calculation. And again, for our listeners and readers in regulation, this is an important but boring exercise. This is the heart of not academic regulatory economics, but policy regulatory economics. The heart of it is these so-called cost-benefit analyses that are done by agencies that are then submitted through the regulatory process to OIRA, the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs within the Office of Management and Budget. And there's 100 or so staff economists in OIRA that look at these kind of EPA or submissions like this that we're discussing, and then say, do they agree or disagree with the analysis, i.e. how fudgy are the fudging is going on, and is this cost-benefit analysis based in reality or based in, boy, we really like this rule and we want to make it look good, different. Each side says this is a cost and this is a benefit, and then we have our costs and you have your costs, and then, you know, depending on one's ideology, you come up with whatever, right? Figures never lie, but liars use figures. And ironically, cost-benefit analysis is the heart of regulatory life, and yet it's very malleable. Mm. And so what should intelligent people make of it? And even I, who have lived my entire life by this, I'm not sure I know. We just have constant regulatory ping pong in which each side does what it wants to do using numbers. And the sad thing is, for someone of my ilk, is it degrades everyone's confidence in the numbers, because it makes it appear as if you can make up whatever you want to get the regulatory analysis to confirm whatever you want. And sadly, that's more true than I would like it to be. And we're discussing today an article that says what the EPA does is rig the figures in a pro-EV way. And some of these are so egregious that they just don't pass the smell test. And we'll leave it to the listener and the readers to see whether they agree or not.
The saying is lies, damned lies, and statistics, right? And so that skepticism is a very old one, that you can make numbers say what you want to confirm your priors. But we have a number here. We have a $1.6 trillion figure. The article is analyzing the EV rule by Paul Boniface and Tim Considine. And they go really blow by blow. But I think the three largest flaws that they point out, they basically say the EPA is wildly overestimating the benefits. And in fact, by the time they're done with their analysis, they say it's not a net benefit at all. It's a net cost. But I think the first one that caught my eye, and that is pretty egregious, is that the $7,500 federal tax rebate. So if you go and buy an EV, as long as it meets certain union boosting made in America requirements, so only some EVs qualify, but as long as it's one of those, you can get up to a $7,500 write-off on your next tax bill. And they count that as pure benefit, which it's a benefit if you take it, but the money came from somewhere, right?
That's their point, which is
a good point.
This literally, in monetary economics, there's this term about dropping money from heaven, and so the turns
helicopter
out
money.
We borrow, right? We're borrowing, so there's cost to future taxpayers. And the EPA analysis counts this money only as a benefit, not as a cost. Mm-hmm. And turns out when you do that, when the money comes from heaven, so that's the most egregious thing that the article finds, is that what really is a cost to society at some point in time, because borrowing has to be paid for, is counted not as a cost, but as a benefit. And they say that's not good.
Though when I looked at the actual, like when they did the breakdown, so some of their analysis was, they would say some of the sections would be like, well, the benefits to national security are overstated, but that's an unpriced, we can't really
They quarrel with it, but they actually don't change the EPA's number.
And I did note that the $7,500 federal tax rebate isn't part of the $1.6 trillion figure. It is a thing that proponents will claim as pure benefit, but I don't think it actually shows up in the $1.6 trillion figure directly. They parse other things like gas savings, electricity costs, and that's where they actually like have dueling numbers that do affect the $1.6 trillion figure. So maybe we should go through some of those.
I think the electricity one was interesting. Well, so
yeah,
the gasoline savings, that's just they use an elasticity estimate, and that's kind of nerdy. So we won't talk about that side. But I thought the electricity side was more easily discussed in an oral context like you and I are doing now, which is the question is in the future, what price should we say people are paying for electricity when they charge their EVs? Mm-hmm. And the EPA used kind of a 10 cent per kilowatt hour number, which is sort of what a home, right? A kind of average US home base there. The Tesla, the superchargers, right, cost 25 cents a kilowatt hour. So it's a guessing game about, what percent of future charging will be high speed versus at home.
Yeah.
And we don't know.
It's complicated because every state, every area has different home electricity prices. So it gets really messy really quickly, right?
And homes don't tend to have the superchargers. And on that, I know, I mean, I don't think they're convert. They're at, gas stations and various places that have these so-called high speed chargers. I have friends who have a Tesla and it's slow at home. This person ran out of electricity on the Delaware Bridge at after midnight coming back from Connecticut towards.
I don't want to do that.
Yeah. And they did not have a happy experience. So range anxiety is a real thing. But anyway, the cost benefit analysis in this article has a big quarrel over what's the right price that people will pay for electricity in the EV world. And the more you use the superchargers, the more it's really double than just doing it at home. Probably.
And that's a big swing. I mean, it's the largest one they have in their analysis, which is the EPA says electricity or fuel savings will be a net benefit of $890 million. So that's over half. And their analysis is that it will actually be a loss of $139 million. So that's a trillion plus swing.
And I think the important thing for discussion purposes here is not that the article is right and the EPA is wrong. It's that the future costs or benefits depend on this important thing, which we know very little about going into the future. And therefore, the analysts' policy preferences play a role in, everyone's going to use superchargers. Oh, that makes it very costly. Or everyone's going to do it at home and the world's going to be fine, i.e. Paul Matz goes, it's EVs a no-brainer. I mean, I'd say both are defensible and unknowable probably at this very point.
True. Very true. So we're playing a little Nostradamus here and making the predictions that are most appealing to the future we want to see, right?
Yes. So
that's a very legitimate caution. I did on that point, there were a couple times where, and I think it's absolutely true that the EPA has an incentive to pick the best possible prediction, the rosiest looking estimates and the rosiest assumptions. But this analysis appears to at times assume the worst, always assume the
it's the not a negative. The authors have a point of view.
Yeah, and which is fine. Yeah.
And people who read it won't be surprised by their point of view. They did the homework that's so hard to do,
right?
Which is this always happens. What's important for readers and listeners to understand is important rules in the government are always accompanied by these 600, 700, 1,000 page tomes. Wow. It takes a long time to slog through and then poke poke at it and see whether it passes the smell test. The readers should and listeners should be thankful that they didn't have to do it and the authors did.
That's right.
And that's right. You can then say, oh, I don't know. This is a cheap shot, blah, blah. But at least they did their homework. And yeah, again, yeah. It's important for us to see what it all looks like when it's subject to sunshine, which allegedly is what the press is supposed to do. But even the New York Times does not expend. I've never seen articles actually in the Journal or the Times. The Times would say Democrats are fine and the Journal would say they're horrible. And they both have articles saying interest groups claim cost-benefit analysis are bogus. But the Journal, right, the kind of old journalism spending a month or two slogging through this and seeing if it makes sense or not, elite journalists don't do that I know of. So we're lucky that these folks did.
I mean, I found it, you know, there were parts that were deeply compelling and then bits where I was like, I'm not sure I would assume. So for example, at one point, they peg increased electricity costs to a proposed power plant emissions rule passing, assuming that it will be passed in its current form, which sure, maybe it will be, maybe it won't be. But so we're stacking an assumption on an assumption, a prediction of another bill that will affect this bill. So we're getting pretty, and then, but at the same time, you know, I would argue that when you do an analysis of, say, vehicle technology costs, which go into the upfront cost of a vehicle, that they point out that EVs cost more than ICE vehicles, and that's true. Well, that's based on the analysis now. And of course, the idea is that as EVs are, that they'll economies of scale as more and more EVs are produced, the cost will come down. Well, how do we know that? Well, because the costs of EVs have already come down meaningfully over the last 5 to 10 years, and there's every reason to expect that trend to continue.
Tesla lowered its prices because it faces competition now, and
right.
That
the question is, why would we choose one assumption that bill will pass and increase electricity costs, but not choose the other assumption, which is that the cost of EVs will continue to fall because of competitive pressures and supply chain effects and economies of scale? They're both assumptions, and of course, which one we choose to highlight is often a function of what we prefer to see happen, right?
I thought the most interesting, or an interesting one for me was, and because of your TikTok video, I the whole notion of internal combustion engines have, quote, maintenance costs and electric vehicles, quote, don't, right? That sort of stereotype. And what they did is said, oh, well, the EPA showed or assumed, demonstrated in this review that, or in the regulatory analysis, that internal combustion engine maintenance costs are, you know, blah, higher than electric vehicle. But what's that come from? And they said, oh, the author said, the EPA assumes that owners of cars follow the manufacturer recommended maintenance intervals. Mm-hmm. And then they said,
No one actually does.
Nobody does that. Well, ironically,
You do? Okay.
I do. I take it to the dealer and I'm dutiful all that because of my personality. But I think I'm not very representative of the world. Now, they brought out what I thought was more convincing than some of the things we've been talking about, real world data.
Kelly Blue Book.
And I said, instead of, remember you said they assume a kind of strong climate bill, which makes electricity very expensive, but you and I both know the odds of that happening are close to zero. So, but then the EPA assumed on the other side, internal combustion engine owners follow the recommended maintenance from a factory recommendation. Oh, yeah, Peter does, but no one else does. And so that turned out to make a big difference.
It did. I agree.
And I said, oh, so ironically, I thought for me, the $7,500 rebate as a benefit rather than a cost and the maintenance assumption was, I thought those were the most interesting to me as a reader.
We'll note just a little, I agree, because Kelly Blue Book, well, it's the, you know, it's they got real skin in the game, right? At the same time, though, I did note a problem there potentially. I'm not a quantitative guy, so I can't tell you how much of a problem it is. But so they report the Kelley Blue Book shows that EV owners spent only 8% less than ICE owners in the first 5 years of ownership on maintenance. That's a real data point. I don't doubt it. It's a good source from Kelley Blue Book versus a 45% difference claimed by the EPA. 8%, 45%, big difference. But that does ignore the fact that the average EV car is more expensive than the average ICE car. And they're because they're competing in, they, for a long time, they've been competing in different segments. Mm-hmm. So EVs, your old Teslas were luxury cars. You know, it's been more recently, we have new Tesla models that are competing in a more.
So you're saying that the
down market,
the more affluent people will a priori, not knowing anything else, just spend more on everything, including maintenance, and follow recommendations because they can afford to. And thus, you're saying, as the demographics and composition of owners go down the income distribution, the maintenance inferences made by the authors cannot be extended as the demography ownership changes.
I think of it intuitively. A BMW has higher maintenance costs than a Honda Accord. Oh,
BMWs.
But this isn't just a function of, it's also a function of a luxury car segment.
Right.
I mean, the number of luxury cars in the line is small. The parts are thus more expensive. So if you have to replace a part, it costs more than the mass market. Especially if it's German or foreign or an EV. So for a long time, I can't tell you how much of that difference, 8% to 45%, I would chalk up to that. But I bet you some of it is just intuitively, basically.
It just shows you, notice,
we're
conducting an oral cost-benefit analysis in real time, and notice the set of things you can add in the footnotes and the questions can go on and on and on. And so the 700-page thing would turn into even longer. And then we could have, we could actually label them. I mean, we could do a Cato cost-benefit analysis, a Heritage, a HUD, a Urban Institute, right? Every interest, every thoughtful entity in American politics has their own sort of way of doing things. And each of them could come up with a version of this and then have at it, which is sort of what we do, right?
Well, and honestly, the number of variables is so vast that it gets incredibly complicated. So just another small one that doesn't show up in the analysis. Well, it does show up in this sense. They note that tires wear out more quickly with EVs.
They made a big deal with that.
Tires, big deal. And that's true. I don't doubt this is a true statement. I think 25% faster, they quote some Goodyear executive, I think, on that regard. I don't doubt that that is true. But how would you attempt to price in the fact that everyone's anticipating that we're about to transition from lithium-ion batteries to solid-state batteries, lithium at first and then other materials first, which get you the same charge at half the weight?
That would change everything.
It would change everything, and it's coming. These companies are spending massive amounts of money on these batteries. The first cars are going to be in production next year with some of these batteries.
We don't know. Well,
the effect on tires.
Whether it's going to work or whether it's the old critique of economists that we tell in Econ 101, which is assume a can opener. Assume that that the transition you're talking about will work. I'm pretty neutral about this. It's like, if something is really the best thing since sliced bread, you won't need a rule to make people buy it. People will buy it. And thus, the wrestling match we're now describing will be unnecessary. And if it really is expensive, the EPA will still try to invent a rule that says it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
The people who believe, right, the EPA under Democrats will produce such a rule,
and the EPA under
Republicans will say this thing is just a it's a Lamborghini. Don't, it can't be cost effective. And so,
which the market is giving us signals right now, which is that EV adoption is up. It's hitting record heights around the world and in the US, but it's not happening as fast as boosters want it to. It's in the middle, but it's happening. Correct. It is happening, which is more than I think people who are critics of EVs for a variety of reasons want. So the market's giving us a mixed signal. And that's one thing politics abhors. You know, my priors are EV transition is inevitable based on current price trends. We'll see. But that means the government should keep its sticky little fingers out and let the market do its thing.
That's actually the heart of libertarianism, to remind our listeners. It's not that we're concerned, right? People misjudge it. We are neutral. We want the government to be neutral with respect to as much as possible. And the use of coercion to put the thumb on the scale is what we're against.
Now, if you thought a cost-benefit analysis of electric vehicles was complicated, it's even harder to sort through the assumptions and competing definitions when it comes to the subject of our final segment, poverty. Now, we have an interesting book review. Hopefully, it'll make a splash because the book it reviews made a splash, was widely covered by major national publications. But it's Matthew Desmond's new book, Poverty by America. We have a review by John Early in this issue of Regulation. And it's interesting, Desmond is a sociologist, not an economist. And I suspect that is going to show as we talk about the book review here. Now, when discussing poverty, we should probably start with defining our criteria for poverty.
Well, the official definition of poverty was started by an economist in the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Molly Orshansky. It's back in the 50s, President Eisenhower asked for petition. And it was that they took how much food a family of four consumed and then multiplied by three. And then that number has been scaled up by the CPI ever since. And the point of Desmond's book and then this review of it is, well, there's pre-tax and transfer poverty rates. And that's the official poverty level of the United States that you often hear about, which is sort of 11% or 12%. And then in recessions, it's up to 15%, et cetera. And then it always is a kind of 10 or 11 or 12.
Very steady, though, based on that assumption, right?
Right. And what this book review talks about is, oh, but the United States redistributes. We have welfare, right? We don't call it that anymore, but we have what are economists call tax and transfer programs. We have subsidized healthcare and housing and education.
Food stamps.
Food stamps. We don't call it, the SNAP program, supplemental nutrition program. And the book review talks about if you include all of those in your measure of poverty, so post-tax and transfer poverty, the rate plummets down to somewhere in the 1% range. And that gets lost often in journalistic, particularly even the elite press. Although the Times is starting to pick up on that there are post-tax and transfer measures of poverty and then the traditional pre-tax and transfer measure. And that's kind of
surprising. I mean, because you would imagine, well, that's a huge win in the war on poverty. If you just said in a vacuum that poverty's fallen from whatever, you know, in the teens or even higher in the 1950s and 60s down to 1% or 1.1% is I think the number I saw in the review, that's an incredible win. I mean, so if you're in favor of government tax and transfer policies, you should be taking a victory lap, it seems like.
And even liberals don't talk that much about this. So Desmond, right?
Yeah.
Pretty obvious liberal political ideology. That's not central to the book. And so that is oddity number one. Mm-hmm. Conservatives, on the other hand, the favorite word, and one will hear this at Cato as well, is the word dependency. So for heritage-style conservatives, as well for some libertarians, and Cato's divided on this, actually. I won't go in, but anyway, the Alan Reynolds, one of our older senior fellows, makes Early's points in his blog post at Cato over and over again, which is poverty's not as bad as it is. Look at the post-tax and transfer data. Mm-hmm. Well, it's ironic because Cato's sort of opposed to taxing and transferring.
Yeah.
So
look at how the thing we don't like works.
Well, he doesn't say that, but he doesn't seem to know that. So I, at least when I read those things on Cato, I find it odd that they're on Cato. And traditionally our more explicit poverty experts at Cato have used the word dependency to describe what they dislike, which is they want the poor to be not dependent. Well, then you're back into Desmond's world, which is, wow, they wouldn't be doing very well without tax and transfers. So the dilemma for libertarians is, where do we sit on this? And you and I are not going to decide that today. We can discuss it. Second thing I'd like to talk, we could talk a bit about the programs, just some numbers. So we spend $115 billion on Medicaid, $56 billion on the Earned Income Transfer Credit, which goes to poor families that work. Welfare reform in 1996 got rid of traditional welfare, which is we gave poor women, single women, money to take care of their kids, and we forbade them to work. Mm-hmm. Right? We've used to...
Which led to the old welfare queen discourse of the 80s and 90s.
Correct.
Which was often the very racist. Yeah.
Correct. And then, but they did what the behavior was because right. The law required them.
We incentivized that. Then we criticized them for doing the thing we incentivized. Yes.
And yeah. I'm going to come back to that later. Then 1996, Bill Clinton signed welfare reform, and we ended traditional AFDC and converted it to TANF, Temporary Aid to Needy Families. Mm-hmm. That's now only $13 billion, right?
It's gone smaller, I think, than most people would. Like, if you just went on the street and asked people what the largest one of these programs was, I suspect they would think that. It's kind of like how people think foreign aid is a massive part of our budget.
Even though it's
a rounding error.
Same thing
feels
for welfare.
A bit like that.
What the public thinks of as welfare is almost non-existent now. The biggest program we have is the Earned Income Tax Credit, which, given that you work, the federal government then kicks in a bunch up to some point, and then that credit declines as your income rises, which is actually something maybe I was going to get into it later, but that's the point, which is incentives matter. So you said the old system, we criticized single minority women because they didn't work, but of course they couldn't and get aid. Now you have to work to get aid. But once your income rises somewhat above minimum wage, the benefit, the earned income tax credit declines drastically with respect to earned income. And the effective tax rate on people at about the poverty level is about 50%, which is higher than the rates that Republicans worry about on rich people on the real income tax. And so one reason work effort is less than it ought to be in the poverty community is because, as you said, we incentivize them not to increase their income very much, because if they do, the EITC goes away. And worse, they lose Medicaid, right? That's the big, there, that's still a threshold, which is if you're a couple of dollars over the qualification number, you lose your Medicaid benefits. They go from real to zero. And that's...
I think folks who've never spent any time moving in impoverished communities, they fail to appreciate how sensitive folks are. Folks who are poor are to the incentive structure. So, like, I worked at a small community bank in inner city Philly when I was in grad school. So, the bank teller and my fellow bank tellers, many of them were recipients of all of us. I received the EITC, tax credits, and many of them received SNAP and other benefits as well. And they were very sensitive to ways in which, so some of them would only do part-time work at the bank because if they went full-time, well, they'd be away from their kids more than they wanted to be. And so, you know, they would go part and they would, their income would increase such that they wouldn't qualify for food stamps anymore or some other benefit. And so people who are poor spend a lot of time, effort, and energy thinking about the incentive structure that's presented them and optimizing their income strategy to, you know, to it, which is a very human natural reaction.
And then we criticize them for their,
and then we criticize them
their lack of work behavior.
Right. Incentives matter. And I think incentives matter the most to the people who are most affected by those incentives. I think that's a good kind of cautionary note to all of this.
I was stunned, but just to, so incentives matter. And then the amount that the listener should know. So how much have transfers increased in since the 70s, since the start of the war on poverty? The answer is, I was even stunned. I'm supposed to know all this. 369% in real dollars.
Wow.
From 1967 to 2017. That's just,
it's huge.
So we do from a, so we're back to, they are dependent and we are against dependency. And, but within the dependency is a whole bunch of perverse incentives which make them dependent. So single women now didn't used to work. Now they work. Now they worry about daycare. We have a, we've transferred the old discussion. We now have a subsidized daycare discussion. Because they work at low-wage jobs, and then they need someone to take care of their kids, and they don't earn enough, and so we, blah, 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 blah. We have to subsidize daycare. And again, incentives matter. So the irony is to have a poverty tax and transfer program that has good incentives, then middle-class people have to get small checks from the government. Mm. Well, that annoys voters. So a lot of politicians, a lot of voters say we should confine poverty programs only for the poor. You shouldn't get, if you're working and whatnot, you shouldn't get anything.
Right.
Well, I don't like it that they get money and I don't. Well, irony, if you have low tax rate on benefits, then people in the $50,000 and $60,000 a year income range, they still have to get, in effect, small checks from the government, and the budget for transfers has to be larger. So that's politically inert. I can sell it to my class, but it's never been politically
viable. Yeah.
And so we end up with, we have lots of transfers and then we have fairly steep cutoffs and we have dependency.
You get these cliffs then as people. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And anyway,
it'd be wonderful if this was easy to solve. If it was an easy to solve problem, we would have fixed it already, I suppose.
It's intellectually easy, but it's not politically or sociologically easy. Implementable. At least I have not seen anyone run for office saying, I want to increase the budget for transfers and decrease the rate at which we tax them.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's a winning platform.
Yes, PVD for president.
Oh, that's right. I'll vote for you, Peter. That's right. Maybe we can go through some of the, a big chunk of the review focuses on its critiques by Early of Desmond's mechanisms that Desmond blames poverty on. Any favorites or lowlights from that kind of back and forth? Like Desmond says, poverty, it happens because of this. And Early says, well, actually,
Desmond, I mean, again, the early point, it's a conservative point, is that if you graduate from high school and you work full time and you marry before you have children.
The success sequence, it's called, I guess.
And very little poverty in those people. And if you fail all three, you don't graduate from high school, you don't work full time, and you have children before you marry, 76% of those people are poor. And that's what some people at Cato and many people at Heritage focus on those sociological distinctions and say, aha, the fill in the blank, the character, right? We need to worry about the culture of people and how they behave. And there are people who deserve transfers and help. And then there are people who
don't because they made bad decisions.
Yes. And that debate has gone on my entire intellectual lifetime.
I'm also struck as we talk about the success sequence, people who have means and come from means assume that it's as easy for everyone as it was easy for them. Like those things are easy for someone who looks and acts and grew up a certain way. It doesn't mean it's equally easy for everyone else. So take high school graduation. It is relatively easy to graduate from high school if you're in one of the top, like I live in a nice area in New Jersey. It's one of the top 10% of public school systems in the state. It'll be easy for my son to graduate from high school. It'd probably be less easy if he was a few miles away in the Trenton public school system, where graduation rates are vanishingly low. There's lots of crime issues in the schools. The schools are a mess. It's hard. So if he struggled in any way at all, he's not getting good counseling, mental health counseling help like he would have here at this school. He's not getting good extra academic tutoring help like he would at this school. So all those things, you know, something as simple as graduating from high school can be have a wide range of difficulty depending on which high school we're talking about, right? And that's true of each of those components.
There's too many upper middle class white people that don't have a clue about what it's like to be poor. Well, I'm sympathetic because I grew up in a trailer in northern New York. I'm white
trash. Rural poverty, yeah.
And I, no one else at Cato has my background. And they're all affluent, right? I think it's, so there's a lack of sensitivity. And my father worked, and it's like it still wasn't enough money. So we five of us were raised. Well, my father failed as a farmer. It's a long story anyway. It's the history of dairy farming in northern New York. It went from small scale. So grandpa had 16 cows. My father had 12. Grandpa went to Cornell Ag, right? Mm. And so, but then farming, so it went from milk cans to bulk tanks. You needed capital to make the transition, and neither my grandfather nor my father did. The plant that took cans closed in 1960.
Mm. So that was the death knell for...
So my father's farm, it just, what are you going to do? So he went to work in a scrapyard in Watertown.
Wow.
And then, oh, irony, he died of mesothelioma, and we think he got it from brake linings working in the scrapyard in 1960. I think middle-class people where everything they know works, and I'll use that in quotes, it's what you're talking about, we really have no idea about the dysfunction. And so what all the little phrases we use, getting your act together, all this stuff that it is, as you said, we cannot imagine how difficult it is for some people to do that. And then getting into the intersection between mental illness and homelessness and poverty, that this book review, nor the Desmond book, actually tackles that. I was, when I was an intern in the Massachusetts legislature in 1975, I worked actually, interesting, this podcast, we talk about the Dodd-Frank Act. Barney Frank was representative from Massachusetts. Anyway, Barney Frank was the teacher of my internship class at MIT.
Oh, okay.
He was going to Harvard Law School at the time and teaching and a member of the legislature, right? A real slacker. And so I was an intern, part of the deinstitutionalization movement and passed that law in Massachusetts, getting rid of mental health hospitals, right? Well, we don't have them anymore. And now all the people that used to be locked up in horrific ways are now out on the street in horrific ways because we'd never figured out how to do decentralized mental health, housing, et cetera, et cetera, because no one wants it in their neighborhood, you know, on and on and on and on. So I don't have answers to that. I mean, it's like what did that component of poverty. So one reason some people don't get their act together is literally they have genuine mental health issues and that trying to figure out what component of what percentage of people who don't have their act together or poor have that component is extraordinarily difficult, I think.
Yeah. Well, and there's a bunch of other kind of optimizations that we take for granted, that you can take for granted as someone who's middle class, like the idea that it's worth it to, that you should strike it out on your own and be the, you know, it's good to be the first one to go to college. It's good to try to have a career, you know, to improve your social status above that of your parents. You should aspire to more and to leave, to be better, to get out.
In some households, you're taught not to.
No. And your highest good that you're taught is to remain in the same neighborhood you were born in, to stay in contact, to be close, a close-knit family and community. Mm-hmm. To you'll know the same people. The same people will be at your funeral as are at your birth or, mm-hmm. or at your you get the idea. And these are cultural values. I mean, it's not obvious to me that that's incorrect, right? The middle class ain't no me where we leave and try to improve and see our families once a year, maybe on the holidays. And then we put our parents into retirement homes and never see them until they shuffle off the sort of coil.
That's an abomination for many, many.
An utter abomination. Yeah. And I'm not sure they're wrong. So we have an optimized strategy that is really good at decreasing poverty. Middle class, cultures are really good at decreasing poverty. Does that mean they have pursued the best strategy for human well-being? I don't know. That's a value judgment. That's really tough to make.
Correct. Agreed.
We use. One more point here on Desmond. So that bit about that kind of unwillingness to. Maybe it's just an ignorance and an unawareness of how much progress tax and transfer programs have made on the actual poverty rate. But how much of this is, do you think, because of political utility? Like, if you're an anti-poverty activist and you want more to be done, there's an incentive for the problem of poverty to look as bad as possible, as unchanged, as unaffected by past efforts as possible. Like, are we dealing with?
Well, activists certainly say that. I think the puzzle for me is the EITC grew under Bush. It grew under Republican administration. But Republicans don't want to talk about poverty because I think their voters, it's linked to race too mm-hmm. often. And it's the dirty little secret of moderate Republicans is they were behind this large redistribution that we are talking about today, but they don't talk about it. Mm-hmm. And Democrats still talk as if we're not doing anything. So you have a political rhetorical equilibrium, which is factually opaque and incorrect. And voters don't know what we're talking about today, and they take their cues from political elites often, and they're getting bad cues.
We're left with people who care about poverty aren't measuring it right, and they don't have the right understandings of how it works, and thus what we should do about it. And it's useful to point that out. That's, you know.
The mission of Cato and the mission of think tanks is to talk about facts and reality and make more people aware of what we think of as data-based reality. And I've been teaching and thinking about this stuff for almost 40 years now. And my old lectures from 1987 don't look a heck of a lot different than what we're talking about now, which is sad. One final thing, completely different, but related. We haven't talked about the European welfare state and the left, the notion on the left that we need to be like them. Europe has greater support for the poor. But they don't what most Americans don't realize is paid for by the VAT, by the VAT. So the tax and transfer system in the U.S. is very progressive. The one in Europe
tax
is
income, and it's skewed towards higher income.
We tax rich people in the U.S. and we redistribute to the poor. We really do, even though no one thinks that. And they think Europe does that, but Europe does not.
It's a regressive system. It taxes stuff. Every time you buy anything, the VAT is
16% sales tax in European countries.
And obviously consumption is a larger portion of expenditures for low-income households.
Capital in Europe is not taxed as much as it is in the United States. So that's the irony of another irony of this whole discussion. Is the European welfare state, which is much better in the eyes of the American left, is actually not progressive.
Because it's actually not, it's not
paid for by workers.
Yeah.
Who have faced very high consumption taxes.
Yeah. Yeah.
There you go.
We but the absolute dollar numbers look larger on paper. And so
that is true, but it's not, it has not come from the top.
So in other words, a poor person in Europe, yes, receives more transfer support.
Correct.
But they also have to pay more for everything.
Correct.
On the consumption end.
Yeah. So the net, you know, lifetime redistributive nature of the system in Europe is not as great as it is in the United States.
Huh. I didn't know that until now, and I don't think I'm alone. Counterintuitive insights abound anytime you talk with Peter Van Doren. Well, that's our show. Thank you for downloading and subscribing. Until next time, be well.